Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Dear precious Blood River Radio family, I tell you, it's such a blessing here to be working with such wonderful, wonderful people that we have here. I'll tell you what, I've just tingled. We've got such great people here. I love them so much. We picked up another one this third hour. The Bitter Ender himself, Gene Andrews. I tell you what, you people out there, I know you love the history lessons he brings on board. And I don't know of anybody, and I was in college at one time, I've never seen a history instructor with the depth of knowledge and the broad range of knowledge he has. If you want, and people, I know you know this, I'm not preaching to the preachers, but if you want to hear true, righteous, honest history, the way it really happened, you need to go no further than Blood River Radio when you have the professor himself, the Bitter Ender. He's a Renaissance man. He's
Eddie,
a warrior.
I wouldn't last 5 minutes in a college today. The liberals would be out there screaming and crying and rolling in the floor and kicking their feet up and down having a fit. So,
well,
no,
hopefully they'll have
heart
attacks.
In a college today.
But, Gene, that's a compliment to you. That would be a compliment to you.
Yes, but it wouldn't pay the bills, that's for sure.
Well, we have to go out and sell pencils and ribbons and stuff to pay the bills. Well, anyway, we're going to have the Bitter Ender. He's going to be coming on and giving one of his
no,
branded.
Take care of Monica and what y'all were covering in the last hour. Let's make sure we get that covered.
Yeah, that's what we'll do. Obviously, letting people know that's what we're going to do. There is store up for the second part of the third hour. Go ahead. So y'all were talking about some super fascinating stuff about this Rossier guy. I've never heard of him. If you will, Sister Braveheart, tell us about him. I'm just fumbling with the mouth wanting to hear that.
Yeah, you could say this is really one of the most important people in terms of starting off or kicking off the revisionist movement. And the revisionist movement is what those who have taken a second look at what we were told happened in Germany with the alleged gas chambers and all that. And Paul Rassigny and Nancy Hitt, she did a book review about him. But right now, I'll just tell you what I've just recently was listening to an interview that Jim Rizzoli did Robert Forisson in 2015. And Forisson, you know, he was in France and he was very against the Nazis as he was a child back then. He was born in 1929. So during the war, he was a child. And of course he was against the Nazis because he was in France. And then he came across Paul Rassigny's writings, I believe, or I'm not sure how he found out about him. I don't remember that part. But Paul Rassigny was in two of these concentration camps, and he was there because, Nancy, correct me if I'm wrong, he was a partisan, right? So he was a communist.
Yeah. I think he was a communist. I believe he was a partisan too. A partisan. Yeah.
Right. So he had been in two of these camps, and when Paul Rassigny was hearing what was being said about these camps, like gas chambers and all these big tall tales, he was a man of integrity who didn't like that these tall tales were being told, and he had firsthand experience, so he objected. He spoke about those things. I think he wrote a book, didn't he?
Yes.
So anyway, that's what started a lot of people. Like, I know I've heard Ernst Zundel talk about Paul Rassigny and the book that was put in front of him that Paul Rassigny wrote, and that was what started him on his journey of you know, seeking the truth about what really happened in World War II. And same thing with Robert Folisson. And Robert Folisson, I mean, it turns out that he did an extremely large amount of inquiry and research and what do you call it when somebody does original research, like they do hands-on research, they go on site and they actually do the there's a word for that. What's that?
I'll forget that term. I know.
Yeah, instead of just reading what other people have written, they actually do the actual. There's a word for it. Forensic. I can't think of it right now.
It wouldn't be forensic by any chance.
But anyway, so Paul Rassigny, and that's all I'll say about him. That's what I remember about. You know, it's very important because he was there in two camps, and so he wrote a book after he saw that they were lying to the world about what was going on in those camps. He never saw anything like that, what they were describing, you know, gas chambers. There was no such thing. So then all the forensic evidence bore him out. You know, Paul Rassigny was telling the truth. So he's a very important man. So that's over to you, Nancy.
Is he dead?
Oh, yeah. In fact, you know, he died from exposure in the camps.
My God.
He was physically debilitated, but I say he was a very courageous, honest man.
You know, this is an aside. We're going to do a historical lesson using The Synagogue of Satan, the great, great book by Andrew Carrington Hitchcock. We also need to do, if we get time, I'd love to start and do a forensic analysis of that great leader, general, later to be president, Eisenhower. May his soul rest in hell for what he did. But we need to expose him. We need to do a series on him someday. Well, anyway,
you know,
people,
I wrote about him called Evil Ike. I did a book review on Ike.
We need to do a project on him someday.
From day one, he was no good. He was a louse.
Yeah, he was promoted over, God, I forgot how many hundred superior officers,
you know,
much superior to him.
Bernard Baruch is the one who promoted him. And being a wealthy Jew, and of course now some people say Eisenhower was Jewish, but he had no real military background to back up his position. But he was given that position over people who'd actually been in the military forces and seen action. But
what Douglas MacArthur said about Eisenhower. He said when he got promoted to Supreme Allied Commander, MacArthur just kind of shook his head and said, "Well, he was the best staff officer I ever had." So, you know, he never had a combat billet. He was a paper shuffler.
He said he was the best clerk he ever had.
Yeah.
Y'all, are we ready to go to the history lesson from the bitter ender?
No, I didn't want to cut Monica off. If y'all had anything else on the book review.
I'm going to sign off. I'm going to tune in and listen from the other side, but I'm going to sign off now. Thanks so much.
Okay, Monica, always good to hear from you.
Thank you, Brave.
You too, Gene. And
thank you.
Bye,
Monica.
Nancy. Bye, Eddie.
Bye, honey.
Bye, sister. Well, folks, we're ready. The professor himself, the bitter ender, is ready to do it like no one else can do. Now, I'm not BSing you. I mean, I always love it. So fire away, bitter ender.
We were talking last week. I couldn't be on last week. We had a pack of Cub Scouts that camped out at the Forest Home last weekend, and they came out on Saturday morning, set up camp, and you know, they stayed over Saturday night. So I had to be there and kind of keep an eye on things. And Eddie is asking me if I'm going to camp out there. I said, no, I don't do that anymore. I got all the camping I wanted in Vietnam. If there's an indoor place, I'm going indoors where it's air conditioned.
Gee, you weren't supposed to say that because our listeners think that I told them you loved a 25-mile forced hike through the woods. Well, y'all didn't have a flashlight.
Yeah, right. Yeah, with two bad knees. Yeah, I couldn't go 25 feet. So, no. But anyway, they're great people. We love having them out there. They have a spring camp out in the winter, and they clean up all the dead limbs and things and use them for their firewood. And when they leave, they don't leave a speck of paper, anything around. They get everything cleaned up. So they're some of the best groups that we have to come out there. So usually what I do, I give them a good history lesson about forest and the forest home. And one year I'll dress up my Confederate uniform and explain what the blanket roll was for and the haversack and show them all the stuff that went in there. And then show them what the cartridge box was and have those pre-rolled paper cartridges and always show them how they loaded a muzzle loader and put the percussion cap on it and fire a couple of shots for it because they like it because it makes a lot of noise and a lot of smoke. But then this year we had something a little different. we had a setup of miniature soldiers. And this is a collection that I've started on, gosh, way back when I was in the first grade, and then got better at painting them and putting more accurate equipment on them. It's just been a hobby down through the years. And they're 54 millimeters tall, or approximately 2 1/4 inches, so that's 1/35th scale. And I used to go to these schools and do demonstrations with my uniform, and a lot of times the students would ask, well, how'd they fire a cannon? So I'm holding my rifle up and explaining how they loaded a cannon, and I thought, well, now that's stupid. I've got 2 dozen of these little miniature cannons at home. Why not set up something that you can show? So that's what I've done. I took about 20 of these wooden plaques that were the backing for, like, sports awards. You know, it has a medal thing on, you know, the district champion or something like that. They were getting rid of them at a school where I used to work. And so I said, yeah, I'll take all of those, and took the metal off and sanded it down and painted it. And then I would put them on, put the soldiers on there for the Confederate Army, the Navy, and the Marine Corps, and explain the infantry, artillery, and cavalry, and then how they did set this thing up, and all of that, to give them a better explanation so they could actually see how the military was organized in the 1800s. And so we'll just kind of go through that. I know it's kind of hard for our listeners to see this, but hopefully I can explain it well enough. The first thing we had was the infantry regiment, how it was organized. And we'll come back to that after the break, and we'll start with the infantry and go through the Army and then the Navy and the Marine Corps.
I can't wait to hear it myself, folks.
Introducing Managed IT Services from NPI. We offer top-notch data backup and recovery, email spam protection, and network security tailored to your needs and budget. With 20-plus years of experience in the medical field, our HIPAA-certified consultants know what it takes to protect sensitive information. Don't settle for less. Give us a call at 801-706-6980 and experience the difference with Managed IT Services. Remember, your IT support should be fast, efficient, and reliable.
Blood River Radio is the only news media in the United States whose sole purpose of being is to fight against the ever-rising tide of global white genocide, both soft and hard genocide, whether it is in the form of ethnic cleansing via the current massive invasion of non-white, non-Christian hordes that are overwhelming the once all-white nations of Western Europe, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United States, or via the hard genocide in South Africa, where the rape, murder, and torture of whites is an ongoing daily occurrence. Though we are a Christian brotherhood, we will cooperate with other groups in our operations if it will shorten our people's casualty list. We further pledge to you to leave the radio studio at every opportunity and take it to our churches, to our universities, and most importantly, we promise to occupy the streets. However, none of our mission can succeed without funding. Please help us all that you can and donate to our cause by going to www.bloodriverradio.com.
Introducing PrepStartsNow.com, your ultimate guide to readiness and peace of mind. We offer practical preparedness tools, training, and education to take your family's household readiness to the next level. Browse the prep shop for essential products, check out our planning guides, and stay informed with our prep blog. Visit PrepStartsNow.com and subscribe to our emails for exclusive offers, new products, and future events. Remember, preparedness begins with PrepStartsNow.com.
A Venus is a 44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off. You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, Bunk?
Here at Blood River Radio, before we go back to Sister Nancy, we were just talking about Memphrica and how I ride down right through the middle of the black slums to get to the stairs. And one morning I was taking a photograph of that wonderful place. We have the National Civil Rights Center here in Memphis. And we have that hotel Martin Luther King was assassinated. And I was thinking we'd get a hold of that property right across the street from it. We put in the James Earl Ray Shooting Gallery and charge admission for that. But anyway, I don't know how well that would go.
Mr. Rhett, you is bad.
Yeah. Anyway, I will not say what anything else because it might give me away with a little operation I got planned. But anyway, Sister Nancy, well, I guess I'll go back to calmer heads, people that are more sane. So we'll go back to you.
No, I think you better go.
Nancy, go ahead.
Gene, I think you were trying to explain how the infantry and the Navy
and
all.
Something you wanted to finish up from a previous segment. So go ahead.
It wasn't from previous. All I wanted to comment on was that Columbus Day is Monday.
Oh, that's right.
And I'd like to know if some of these bleeding hearts who are complaining about Columbus, I wonder if they would like to get in one of those little boats, that the little ships that he sailed across the ocean, and maybe take a trip on the ocean for maybe 60 days and see how they how he likes it. If they think that they're so brave and they think Columbus was such an evil man. I just have a couple notes about Columbus, that he was an Italian explorer, and he completed four Spanish-based voyages sponsored by the Catholic monarchs, Ferdinand and Isabel, and there was 1492, which we all know, 1492, 1493, 1498, and 1502. And he was born in 1451 in Genoa, Italy, and died in 1506. He wanted to find a direct water route to Asia. Columbus started out on merchant ships, and then he was, until 1476, he ended up in Lisbon, Portugal, where he studied math, cartography, and navigation. And August the 3rd of 1492, he set sail in the Niña, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. On October the 12th, the ships landed on one of the Bahamian islands, and they left some of the men on, believe it or not, at Haiti in Dominican Republic in 1493. I'm assuming they did not survive. I think my understanding is when they returned the following year that settlement had been devastated. They were acting up back then, even in Haiti. But what I'm getting at, basically, is I want to say something good about Christopher Columbus. I'm sick of hearing what an evil man he was. I would like to see, I would like to hear that some of these bleeding hearts are brave enough to do anything like what Christopher Columbus and his men did in sailing across the ocean to an unknown destination in these tiny little ships. Years ago, I think it was the Niña that had a reconstructed caravel landed here in Louisville. These things were tiny. And what I'm getting at, you know, everybody wants to cry about what he did to the local people and the Indians and slavery and all of that. It's they want to berate him, but they don't also want to recognize his courage. So that's just my take. Monday is Columbus Day, and I guess a lot of statues will be desecrated.
Well, that's the way the left operates. They're such blatant cowards. Name me one thing they've actually done. You know, they didn't discover penicillin. They didn't do the first heart transplant. They didn't do anything worth a flying flip. But they're always eager to tear down what someone else has done, especially if that person has been dead 100 or 200 or 300 years. They're very eager to go tear their statue down or run their name through the dirt. But I've always said I would really enjoy seeing some of these liberals that have torn down these Confederate statues go up to a Confederate veteran about a year or two after the war is over and go and tell them how terrible they were. And I just love to step back and watch posterior kicking that they get from one of those veterans that were still able to, just flat out punch them out and destroy them. So, but they're very brave for somebody that's been dead 100 or 200 years. They can go out there and they can really rip and roar about that. So it just shows you the cowardice that the liberals have in the left or the progressives or whatever they call themselves, New World Order and all that kind of garbage, that just show me something that you people have actually done instead of what all you've torn down. That's what I'd like to see one of these days. Anyway, so much for that. So thank you for bringing that up about Monday being Columbus Day. Appreciate that.
Yes, thank you, Nancy. Mm-hmm.
So we were talking about this Confederate military organization. And on our, if we're moving down the two tables that we have set up, the first one is the infantry regiment. And the way that we're organized, and this is Confederate Army, U.S. Army, British, French, Prussians, pretty much standard organization during the 1800s. It would be made up of 10 rifle companies, and each rifle company had about 100 men and two battalions. First battalion was Company A through E, and then the second battalion was Company F through J, and each of those would be commanded by a lieutenant colonel, and then a colonel was a regimental commander. And that would be full strength to have about 1,000 men in there, and then maybe about a 30-man headquarters platoon. And the interesting point that I make to the scouts is that early in the war, and probably up through the summer campaigns of 1864, a single Confederate regiment could always defeat a Union regiment. And not just because they were Southerners, and although that's a good point to make, though, we would think so, but no. Mm-hmm. What the Confederates would do when new recruits came into the Army, they would split them up and put them in these old regiments to replace soldiers that had been killed or sent home on convalescent leave or whatever. And so now you had a green recruit between two veterans. So they could tell them, hey, kid, get your head down, or you're going to get it shot off. Or, you know, show them how to sleep out on the ground at night during a sleet storm and freezing rain without dying of hypothermia or exposure. Where in the Union Army, Lincoln would get more political clout by handing out commissions for colonels to all these political cronies. And they would raise a regiment, and they'd be the commander as a colonel, but it probably wouldn't have maybe 200 to 300 men in it when they started out. And then when they took casualties, they didn't put the new recruits into these old regiments that were way, way, way under strength. They would organize a brand new regiment because he could hand out a commission as a colonel to another one of his political cronies. Now, the Union Army total was always bigger than the Confederate Army. But if you picked out the 3rd Tennessee to go against the 26th New York or something like that, the 3rd Tennessee, like I said, until later on in the war when the Confederates couldn't replace the losses, the 3rd Tennessee would always beat the 26th New York because they had more veterans and they had a larger number. So anyway, that's the way they were organized. Then we would set up a display of a defensive line that would be three deep. Oh, one other thing, going back to the regiment, they would have a color guard and a color sergeant that would carry the regimental colors. And this wasn't just for parades. It was a symbol of where that unit was on the field. So if you were looking across the battlefield at Murfreesboro or Chickamauga or whatever, and you saw all these Tennessee regiments together, well, you know, that would be Frank Cheatham's division. So you knew who was coming on the field. And it was a way to identify the units and to tell the soldiers, post the colors over there on that fence line. And then we would all know to fall in to the left of our regimental flag. We knew exactly where we're supposed to go. And then I also show them how the officers would use their sword to give directions or give orders. Because when you're on the battlefield and 30 or 40,000 rifles are going off and cannons, I could be standing 10 or 15 feet away from you and yelling as loud as I could. You couldn't hear me. I mean, it makes your head vibrate, even in these reenactments. And that's nothing compared to the real battles. So when an officer would draw that sword and hold it up, you could see the sunlight off that polished blade. And he's holding it over, straight up over his head. He's getting ready to give an order. And when it comes straight down, we're going forward. When he holds it up, points it to the left, the whole unit's going to wheel to the left, points it to the right, we wheel to the right. When he waves it around in a circle, you break the formation and go around a house or a clump of trees and then form on the backside. And then when he gets out in front of the unit and holds us and is walking backwards, facing the unit coming forward toward him, and holds the sword up over his head and then brings it straight down, that's a signal to halt. Everybody halts online. So they could do all that even with all the noise on the battlefield going on. And I tell the people that are there at the program, I said, now you have to remember back then they didn't have radios or walkie-talkies or field phones, and especially for the young ones, I say, and I know you think I'm lying, but they didn't have smartphones or iPhones back then. So you had to have some way to communicate other than electronics.
Well, his smart people instead of smartphones. We'll be right back to the bitter ender as soon as this next commercial break is over, folks.
proclaiming liberty across the land. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
USA News, I'm Jeremy Scott. Israeli authorities say at least 40 people are dead and there are hundreds of casualties after today's surprise attack from the Hamas militant group. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the country is at war with Hamas and, quote, the enemy will pay a price it has never known before. Thousands of rockets were fired from the Gaza Strip and Hamas claims it has captured Israeli soldiers near the Gaza border. Retaliation from Israel has left 198 people dead and another 1,600 injured. The White House National Security Council says the United States unequivocally condemns the unprovoked attacks by Hamas terrorists against Israeli citizens. Kevin McCarthy refutes recent reports suggesting his intention to resign from Congress. News outlets speculated that the California Republican was planning to step down following his removal as House Speaker. McCarthy clarified to reporters that these reports are untrue. He intends to serve until the end of next year and run for re-election. He also emphasized his aim to assist Republicans in growing their majority in the chamber. Conservative leaders have signed a letter endorsing Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio to become the next House Speaker, citing his consistent conservative record. Jordan and House Majority Leader Steve Scalise are the top two contenders for the next House Speaker. President Biden is patting himself on the back after the recent jobs report.
The report revealing that the U.S. economy added 336,000 jobs in September, surpassing economists' projections.
We have the highest share of working-age Americans in the workforce in 20 years. And it's no accident. It's Bidenomics. We're growing the economy from the middle out, the bottom up, not the top down.
Biden emphasized that his administration has generated nearly 14 million jobs since he took office. The unemployment rate has consistently held below 4%. I'm John Schaefer.
And I'm Jeremy Scott. This is USA News.
Omaha Steaks is rewriting the book on burgers with an all-new handmade texture for the juiciest home-style burgers you've ever tasted. Their pure-ground burgers are made from single cuts of real, aged Omaha steaks. These are truly steaks on a bun. Filet mignon, ribeye, New York strip, sirloin, and even brisket burgers. Now is the time to experience the exclusive Burger Perfection Flight for just $79.99. Go to omahasteaks.com and use promo code TREAT at checkout to get an extra $20 off your order plus free shipping. You'll get four of each pure ground burger so you can sample all the steak on a bun greatness. These burgers are crafted for a juicier, more tender experience, making your mouth water with every single bite. Don't wait. Go to omahasteaks.com. Use promo code TREAT at checkout and get $20 off the Burger Perfection Flight and discover your new burger obsession. Minimum order may be required.
Dear Blood River Radio family, I know you can't wait. I can't wait. So we're going to go right back to the Bitter Ender and his history lessons as only he can give. Go ahead, Bitter Ender.
Just a couple of things while we're talking about this infantry regiment. A lot of times a regiment would have their own regimental surgeon and a couple of medics, which you know a lot about, Eddie. To take care of the troops in that regiment. And they would also, we talked about the color guard and the color sergeant. They would also have a lot of times, they would have a regimental chaplain and that would travel with them and be right on the battlefield with them. And one of the most famous chaplains that ever served in the Confederate Army is Father Abram Joseph Ryan, a Catholic priest. And very interesting individual. I don't know if you've ever read a biography. He went into the priesthood, he said, because of his mother. And he said when his mother prayed, he felt like God was right there. And that's why he wanted to be a priest and went to the Christian Brothers in St. Louis. Wow. And entered the priesthood. And then when the war came along, he noticed there weren't any chaplains with the soldiers. And so he volunteered to serve and wound up serving with the Army of Tennessee in some of the major battles. In fact, he was on Missionary Ridge, and actually when Bragg's line broke, they said he picked up a rifle and started firing it. And,
hey, Gene, not to interrupt you, but let me tell you something briefly about Father Ryan. I have, you know, I inherited hundreds of books here at the house, and one of them is a very old book of Father Ryan's beautiful poems. But do you know that Father Ryan died right here in Louisville at in a monastery? It was a German Catholic monastery. And thank God there is still the plaque up. I'm not going to give the address on the church. It's still up mentioning where Father Ryan died here in Louisville.
No kidding.
At this church, and it was a monastery at that time. His and there were lots and lots of Confederate sympathizers who had, you know, who were still surviving at the time he died, and they helped him his body to be removed to New Orleans, I believe.
Mobile. Yep.
What was his full name again, y'all? What was Father Ryan's
Father Abram,
first
name?
Abram
Joseph Ryan. Now, his name originally was Abraham. And he, when Lincoln was elected, he changed it to Abram. He didn't want the same name as the great dictator. So he had his name changed. And after the, well, at the end of the war, he was in Knoxville. And he heard about Lee's surrender. And he was so overcome with grief, he was just despondent. And all he could do was sit down and start writing out a poem. And that poem became The Concord Banner, which is one of the premier poems about the South at the end of the war. And he just did it. It was stayed up all night and tears were flowing down his face and wrote it. And he got that kind of released all of that, you know, anxiety and depression that he had. He just wadded the paper up and threw it away. And the next day, the boarding house or wherever it was, he left, and a girl came in to clean up, and she saw this piece of paper and needed something to start a fire, and she kind of unfolded it and saw there was writing on it. And she started reading it, and she was so overcome that she started crying. Go. And she was the one that sent it in and got it published. And then Father Ryan, after the war, was known as the Poet Laureate of the Confederacy because he wrote a lot of poems. The Concord Banner, The Sword of Robert E. Lee, The Ode to the Confederate Dead, which they still use at a lot of Confederate memorial services today. Wow. And if you don't mind, I just want to read you that first stanza from the Concord Banner.
You're reading it my mind. I was going to ask you to please do that and also to read The Ode to the Confederate Dead.
I don't have all of that, but I did write down I used to memorize it, and they said, children in the schools in the South used to memorize that, but Lord of mercy, they won't let them do that now.
I might be able to find that ode to the Confederate.
Nancy, that's your assignment.
Okay. Book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is Father Ryan's 1838 to 1886, and this is from the Concord Banner. Furl that banner, for 'tis weary. Round its staff, 'tis drooping dreary. Furl it, fold it, it is best. For there's not a man to wave it, and there's not a sword to save it, and there's no one left to lave it in the blood that heroes gave it, and its foes now scorn and brave it. Furl it, hide it, let it rest. That was the first stanza. I think there were about six stanzas in that poem. So, yeah, that's a very very famous Southern individual, and, of course, we have Father Ryan High School here, a Catholic high school here in Nashville today, but they run away from him as fast as their skinny little politically correct legs will carry them. I don't think they have anything about Father Ryan being a Confederate chaplain over there anymore.
Gene, you know something? So, I got to let you know this. This of all the what a paradox. We had a Father Ryan High School here in Shelby County, and it was all black. Who would have thought that? But anyway, I didn't want to interrupt. But you know, one more thing. We've got to get those points.
That's kind of ironic there.
Yes, it is.
So that was covering the regiment. And now we had another plaque set up there with a Confederate defensive line, which they would usually form the regiment in three ranks, three deep. The first rank would fire, and then they would go back to the rear, and the second rank would step up and fire. And about 10 seconds later, the third rank would step up and fire, and they would go back to the rear. So a well-trained soldier could get off two shots in a minute. And so if you had about a 10-second delay on each of these units stepping up to fire, by the time the third rank stepped up to the front and fired and then turned around and went back to reload, that first rank was reloaded and they were ready to fire again. So about every 10 seconds, you had this tremendous volume of fire coming out from your defensive position. And then on the other hand, in the attack, they would be three rows deep. And what Nancy was talking about, the regimental colors would be out between the 5th and 6th Company in front. And that's where he lost so many of the color bearers, because they were targets right out there. But once again, the flag showed the troops where they were supposed to go. And if you were getting out in front of the flag, you had to you needed to slow down. Or if you were getting too far back behind it, speed up, because they wanted your attack, everybody, to hit the enemy line at the same time. And if you had 5 or 10 people that got way out in front, they'd shoot them first. And then here come another 8 or 9, and bang, they'd shoot them. And then here comes another 10 or 12. So, you know, they just pick them off one small group at a time, but everybody coming in there together had a better chance of breaking the line. So anyway, the next demonstration that we had set up was the artillery. And I would have two cannons there, the 12-pound brass Napoleon howitzer, which is sort of the standard field piece for both sides during the war. And then I also had an example of a little miniature of a 3-pound ordnance gun, which is what Forrest liked to use, because this had a rifle barrel, and it had a lot better range. And I had the figures showing what the wormer was, which had run down the barrel. It looked like a big corkscrew on a pole, run down the barrel after the cannon was fired, and turn it to pull out any fragments of the powder bag. Then a guy would run a sponge pole down there with water to put out any sparks. And while all that was going on, they were bringing up a 2-pound cloth bag of black gunpowder, run it down the barrel, and then the officer would tell them what type of shot they were going to fire, a solid shot, which is just a steel ball for knocking down buildings or earthworks, or an exploding shell where they could set a fuse on that to have it explode at 500, 600, 800, 1,000 yards, or canister, which were metal cans full of steel balls, and turn the cannon into a giant shotgun. And then each cannon was pulled by a two-wheel cart with an ammunition chest on it called a limber. And they would use anywhere from 4 to 6 horses to pull that. And as soon as the gun went into action, they would unhitch the horses and take them down into a sinkhole or a ravine or behind a hill. Because if the horses got killed, then you couldn't move the gun. I mean, you can pick it up and turn it and move it, you know, 8 or 10 feet, but not 20 miles down the road. And then each cannon also had a second limber with a caisson that went behind it. And this was another two-wheel cart with two ammunition chests on it and a spare wheel. So, Eddie, that's where y'all get the song, the Army song, the caissons go rolling along. That's what they're singing about right there. The third combat arms of the Army was the cavalry. And this was sort of the epitome of the striking force in the Army of Tennessee, because the cavalry commander after the first couple of years of the war was Nathan Bedford Forrest. And he rewrote the book on mounted warfare. And his tactics are still studied in military schools today all over the world. And he never went to West Point or the Citadel or VMI, but yet they use his tactics and teach it in those schools. They don't say it came from Forrest. Oh, Lord of mercy, they can't.
Oh, hell no.
Oh, gosh, it all fall down in the paint. And these military leaders that we have today, they would the males that we have would pull the skirt up over their head and just have a fainting spasm if they did.
Yes, they would.
But he did, and he had such leadership abilities and skills that people wanted to serve under him. A lot of times, three times during the war, he had commands that he recruited, he trained, and he equipped, taken away from him and given to somebody else. So he would have to go out and scrounge up deserters from the Confederate Army, these guerrilla partisan bands, teenagers that were legally or really too young to be in the regular military, and he would put them together, train them, and lead them, and turn them into one of the toughest fighting forces in the Confederate Army.
Peter Ritter, we'll come right back there as soon as this last break. Can't believe we're almost out of time. Be right back, dear people.
Former Sheriff Richard Mack recounts in his book, The Proper Role of Law Enforcement, how he came to realize while working as a beat cop how wrong the all-too-common orientation of police officers is when they think of their job as being to write tickets and arrest people. Richard Mack tells of his personal transformation from by-the-number cop to constitution-conscious defender of citizen safety and freedoms. Learn what it really means to serve and protect. Purchase your copy at cspoa.org. That's cspoa.org.
Hello, friends. This is Jacob from Blood River Radio. We call the kings into account and tell the truth to shame the devil on this show every week because we are of the firm conviction that our cause cannot succeed without true revival amongst the remnant, amongst that principled minority of the dispossessed majority. Now is the time to stand and be counted, to do like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who would not bow down to the false idols of their day, even under pain of death, like the 300 mighty men of valor who surrounded the Midianites with Gideon, or the 7,000 men that God told the prophet Elijah had not bowed their knees to Baal in a time when even calling fire down from heaven would not awaken our kinsmen from their slumber. If you are encouraged by our labors in the trenches for the kingdom and the cause of truth, liberty, and righteousness, I urge you to consider supporting this program. No donation is too small. We can do with thousands or even hundreds what our enemies and the powers and the principalities of this present darkness need tens of millions to do. So please donate today at BloodRiverRadio.com and help us take up the hedge and stand in the gap against the great evils of our time.
Do you know what is great about America? Ask an immigrant. Ask an Immigrant is a new podcast dedicated to helping Americans, especially our youth, value, appreciate, and be grateful for the freedoms we have here in America. Join host Lydia Wallace Nuttall as she interviews immigrants from around the world to discover their inspiring personal stories about why they came to America. To learn more about why America is the most prosperous, greatest country in the world, download the Loving Liberty app or go to lovingliberty.net.
Dear Blood River Radio fam, we're going to go right back to the professor himself without wasting any more time. Go ahead, Professor.
Well, we wind this up on our last segment. So I tell the people that come to our display with the Confederate military, well, if you don't like walking and you're in the infantry and the artillery makes too much noise and the horses are too smelly, then you can always join the Navy and see the world, or at least see the coastline. And a lot of people don't get much history about the Confederate Navy, and it wasn't as big as the U.S. Navy, but they really had some innovative people. Stephen Mallory was Secretary of the Navy, and he knew that they couldn't match the U.S. Navy ship for ship, so they had to come up with some other things. So one thing he did was start constructing these ironclad ships. And, of course, we've all heard about the battle between the Virginia and the Monitor in Hampton Roads, Virginia. And that was the first battle between two ironclad ships in maritime history. But they built about 24 different ironclads at different ports in Savannah, Wilmington. Of course, that the Virginia, or built over the hull of the old USS Merrimack, was at Gosport Navy Yard in Norfolk, Mobile Bay, on the Yazoo River, and all over. So I think it was about 24, 26 that the Confederates actually built of various sizes. And out of those 26, only one Confederate ironclad was ever defeated in a naval battle. And unfortunately, that was a poor old CSS Tennessee down at Mobile Bay. And it was surrounded by 19 ships of Farragut's Navy, and they just literally beat it to pieces. All the rest of them, though, were destroyed by the Confederates, because the Federal Navy couldn't defeat them. But as an army was closing in on Charleston from the land side, or on Savannah, or on Mobile, or on Wilmington from the land side, or what happened to the Virginia closing in on Norfolk from the land side, they didn't want their ship to fall into the hands of the enemy, so they packed it full of gunpowder and set it on fire and blew it up. So out of all those ships, only one was defeated by the Federal Navy, and the rest were destroyed by the Confederates. Another type of ship they had was a commerce raider. And these ships were sort of the state-of-the-art of their day. They were three-masted sail ships, but they also had steam engines. And two of the most famous were the Alabama, commanded by Captain Raphael Sims. And over the course of their two-year sailing career, they took 69 enemy merchant ships. And the whole idea was that what Stephen Mallory wanted to do was not be fight naval battles, but to cripple the U.S. economy to the point that Lincoln would give us our independence, or at least pull ships off the blockade. And it didn't happen. He wanted to keep strangling the South, so these merchant ships were just pretty much on their own. And by 1864, no foreign country would ship a cargo on a U.S. ship. It was too dangerous, and they couldn't
because
get insurance.
Of the Alabama.
The Alabama, the Shenandoah,
the, Alabama.
The Nashville, the Florida, the Sumter. All these ships were out there hunting for anything with the U.S. flag on it.
You know, I went to Liverpool, and you know the CSS Alabama was built at Merseyside,
built there.
In Liverpool. It took more prizes than any ship has ever done, as far as I know, up to date. And the Shenandoah, they say that in Liverpool, the first shot was fired from the cannon that was manufactured at Liverpool, I guess at Charleston, and the Shenandoah came in and surrendered 6 months after the war ended because Irving Bullock did not know that the war was over, and
no.
They were up there in the
Arctic Ocean. Yeah, the Shenandoah
so
was built in Liverpool.
The war started and ended in Liverpool.
There you go. And it was taken out of British waters, armed as a warship, sailed down the Atlantic, rounded the Cape Town, went across the Indian Ocean, picked up a detachment of Confederate Marines in Melbourne, and went up to the Arctic Ocean and went after the U.S. whaling fleet because they used whale oil for lamps back then. And they took out 32 whaling ships in the Arctic Ocean. So I guess you could say the Confederates were the first ecologists. They were saving the whales before it was the end thing to do.
And you know what I think is interesting? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. And so they turned around.
No,
they were headed. Go ahead.
They were taking out the whalers. But what is interesting about the Alabama, of all of the confrontations it had, they never fired. They would only shoot over the bow or the bow of the offending enemy. They never had anyone to die except in South Africa. In a hunting episode, one of the sailors died there, and he is actually his body was a few years ago taken to the Sons of Confederate Veterans property and buried there.
Yes.
Wow.
Finally got his body back and buried at Elm Springs there. But the Shenandoah then was headed to San Francisco. They're going to raid the Presidio there at Golden Gate Bridge. They stopped a British ship out on the waters to check their papers and make sure it was legitimately a British ship and not a Yankee ship flying a British flag. And it was a British ship. And they told them, well, we're sorry, mates, but your war has been over for about 3 months. Of course, they were up in the Arctic. They had no way of knowing. So what they did, they dumped all their cannons overboard so they wouldn't be considered a pirate ship, sailed on down the west coast of North America, South America, rounded the Horn, came back up the Atlantic, recrossed the equator again, brought it back into the home port at Liverpool. And just like Nancy said, they surrendered the last official Confederate flag to the British on November the 6th, 1865. And so that was the history of some of the commerce raiders. Another ship they used were the blockade runners. Now, these weren't warships. They were built strictly for speed. They were cut down low to the water. They were painted dark gray or black. They would load them up with bales of cotton and wait for a dark, cloudy night. And then they would slip out of the port and run down parallel to the shoreline so that dark ship would blend in with the shore. And then when they figured they'd cleared the Yankee blockade squadron, they'd make a break for the open sea. And they would trade their cotton with the British agents for war materials or medicine or whatever they needed in the South. And they wouldn't go all the way to England. They would meet the British agents in Havana for the Gulf ports, or Nassau or Bermuda for the East Coast towns, Confederate towns. And I guess you know who the most famous blockade runner was of all times, right? Movie Gone with the Wind, when they had the big ball there to raise money, and the master of ceremonies said, "And now here's that will-o'-the-wisp of the bounding main, Captain Rhett Butler." Everybody cheered. Scarlett said, "Well, I didn't know you were such a hero." And he said, "I'm not. I'm in it for strictly for the profit. My hero is Rhett Butler."
He was honest.
But really, if your ship made two trips, it would be paid for. So everything after that was profit. And one year, my wife and I took a vacation over to Nassau, and that one of those old bars down there in the harbor was supposedly there during the war, and that's where a lot of these blockade runner captains would meet the British agents. So I went in there to have a drink, carrot juice, of course, and sit down there and just kind of look around that bar. I thought, now this is kind of cool being here, and those blockade runners would come in here, and I'd look around and say, now that guy over there in that corner, he might be captain of a blockade runner. I thought, nah, that guy looks like an insurance salesman from Toledo. He's not cut out for blockade running. I don't think he could do that. But it was a neat place to be. Another part of the Confederate Navy was the torpedo department, and that was headed up by Gabriel Rains. And what they did, they manufactured, we call them mines today, but they were torpedo, they called them torpedoes back then, floating in the water, and the ship would bump into it, and it would set it off. They even had it electrically detonated mines. People knew about electricity back then. They just couldn't mass produce it to run your washing machine or your TV or, you know, stuff like that. And one of the coolest things they did, they would take gunpowder and mix it with tar and sawdust in these odd shapes and then pitch it on these coal barges that were going out to re-coal the Yankee blockade squadron. And a couple of days later, some guy's down in the hole shoveling what he thinks coal is coal into the firebox in a boiler. And about 2 or 3 seconds later, there's this huge explosion, and down goes another Yankee ship. The torpedo department actually sank more enemy warships than all of the Confederate surface ships and all of the coastal forts combined. So that was a pretty deadly department.
Now that is amazing. Navy.
And, of course, the last part of the Confederate Navy was the submarine, the Hunley. And they called it a diving torpedo boat. And it was designed and built by Horace Hunley, who was originally from Gallatin, Tennessee, and had moved down to New Orleans and drew up the plans. And when New Orleans fell, he took them over to Mobile, and this thing was built in Mobile. And it looked like Charleston was about to go under, so they put it on a railroad flat car and took it over to Charleston. And two crews died in test dives in this thing, and Hunley died. He was in the second crew. And they got this thing up, and it had been underwater for so long, they had to have somebody go down through the hatch. They couldn't get the bodies out of the hatch, and somebody had to go down in there after they got the water out of it and chop up the bodies with a hatchet and pass the parts up out through the hatch to get them out. And then they recruited a third crew to go. And I'm thinking,
look at the guts, look at the courage of our men.
Tell me what happened to the first two crews. Oh, they died in that. And you want me to be the third crew in there? George Dixon was an Army officer that crewed, but on the night of February 17th, and it didn't have a motor. It had a crankshaft, and eight people had to sit on this bench and turn this crankshaft. And they took it out 3 miles and ran an explosive charge into the hull of the USS Housatonic. It blew up, and the Housatonic sank in about 3 minutes. So the Hunley was the first submarine to sink an enemy warship, and the USS Housatonic had the dubious distinction of being the first ship sunk by a submarine. Now, for years, they thought the Hunley went down with the Housatonic, but it was found in 1998, raised in 2000, and it's in that Latch Naval Museum in Charleston. So if you go to Charleston, you can actually see the Hunley, the submarine, the Hunley there. It's been preserved. And, of course, have to put this in there, the Confederacy also had a Marine Corps, just like the U.S. Navy had, and they served on a lot of these ships all over the world. And most of their duty was in the coastal forts, up and down, like at Fort Sumter, at Fort Fisher, at Wilmington, Fort Morgan, at Mobile Bay, and places like that. And the Marines, the first naval attempt by the Federal Navy to steam up the James River and take Richmond from the riverside was turned back by the Marines at Drury's Bluff. They were manning the guns up on the bluff, but there were Marine snipers and sharpshooters all up and down the bank, and they were picking off Yankee sailors out on these ships when they were trying to aim these cannons and fire it up at the bluff there. So they called off that. So it wasn't until the very end of the war that the Federal Navy – the Federal Navy never got into Richmond. When Lee evacuated the lines at Petersburg and Richmond, they had to give up the capital. Admiral Raphael Sims had gotten back to the Confederacy after the Alabama was sunk over at Cherbourg, France. He had gotten back there, and he was put in charge of the James River Squadron, which wasn't much, but he sank all of those ships in the James River so the Yankee Navy wouldn't be the first enemy into the capital at Richmond. So I hope our listeners got a little bit of Confederate military history today and learned a little bit about how it was organized, especially about the Navy, because you really never hear much about that at all.
No, you don't.
You hear a lot about Gettysburg and Shiloh and all of these, but and it's hard to go, almost impossible to go to a naval battlefield because when the ships are gone, they're under the water and that's it. So
true.
Thank you for the time. I hope our listeners enjoyed it.
I sure did. I know they did too.
We
got to come up with them poems on the next time y'all come on. I'm so glad you're back next week, Gene. I know our Blood River Radio family is too. Well, thank you so much, Gene and Nancy and Monica and Mark. But thank y'all, man, what a crew we have. And I'm really looking forward to working with y'all. Same time, same place next week to be the 14th of October. Well, good night, everybody, and thank you for listening to Blood River Radio and supporting us. Without our supporters, there would be no Blood River Radio. So good night, Miss Lizzie.